after I had seen the manager on his difficult horse, and seen the gap between us in age and energy and expectations. But middle age, or the decline associated with it, comes abruptly to some people, and middle age had come as abruptly to me as old age appeared to me then to have come to the old manager. I would have liked to hear the old manager say something about the new farm people. I would have then said, more in tribute to him as someone from my past than because I understood what I saw of the farming around me, how much I preferred his way. But he wasn't interested, so the solidarity went unexpressed. And it was just as well, because, eventually, mysteriously, at least to me, the new venture failed after two harsh, dry summers, summers so harsh that the old mock-orange shrub outside my cottage died. During one of those droughts, I heard talk, on the bus and from Bray, the car hire man, that water wasn't to be brought to the cattle, but that the cattle were to be transported to where there was water. Transported, perhaps, to Wales. Such was the scale and style and reputation of the new venture. I don't know whether anything like that happened, or whether it was just excited local exaggeration. Soon, however, it didn't matter. The venture failed. And even this failure, large as it was, affecting so many people, affecting the eventual appearance of so many acres, seemed to happen quietly. It was some time before I knew that there had been a failure. The machines were there, the cows were there, the men were up and down in their cars, the big trucks came to take away the grain from the metal-walled barn. But then gradually the failure, the withdrawal at the centre, began to show. The prefabricated cowshed next to the barn was opened, front and back, and cleared of its dung and straw. And it remained open, and clean, though stained, and empty. The stalls, the concrete floor with its canals, the slatted timber of the walls striping the sunlight, radiating it at many angles and giving the shed an internal glow. The new milking building or parlour was taken down, so newly put up its concrete platform, all that remained, still so new and raw-looking on the hillside. It was like Jack's greenhouse. That, too, had left only a concrete floor. Again, here, building had been on too big a scale too big for men. Needs had been exaggerated, had ramified, and had left a ruin. An empty cowshed that might eventually be taken down and sold elsewhere. A milking machine that no doubt had already been sold, leaving only a concrete floor. So small in the openness now, that floor, where the milking machines had hummed and hissed, and dials had kept check of this and that, while the dung-stained cows, corralled into their iron-railed passages at particular times, had waited with a curious stillness to give milk to the machines after being walked up the hill to the cowmen's shouts, the only human remnant of the milking ritual. The cows themselves eventually disappeared. Some would have been sold, but whether sold or not, what would have happened to them would have been what always happened to cows when their time was judged to have come. Batches of them were regularly taken off in covered vans to the slaughterhouse. I had seen the cows on the hillsides, against the sky, heads down, grazing, or looking with timorous interest at the passing man. And they had seemed like the cows in the drawing on the label of the condensed milk tins I knew in Trinidad as a child. Something to me as a result at the very heart of romance. A child's fantasy of the beautiful other place. Something which, when I saw it on the downs, was like something I had always known. I had seen the big eyes, the occasional mild stampede of the herd as, within their pasture, they had followed the walking man, thinking he had brought them something tasty, or was to lead them to something they had been trained to like. I had seen the big, wet, black noses, the fly repellent in the metal sachets clipped to the ears, which they flapped like heavy fans. One sees what one sees. Harder to imagine, unreal, what one doesn't see. It had taken me some time to see that though milk came from cows that had dropped calves, no calf was to be seen, except very sick ones, little, seemingly fluid sacks of black and white, or brown and white, on straw, creatures still seeming fresh from the womb. And no cow with its calf. No lowing herd winding o'er the lee here, as in Gray's Elegy. No sober herd lowing to meet their young at evening's close, as in The Deserted Village. pictures of especial beauty at one time, those lines of poetry matching the idea of the cows on the condensed milk label. Especial beauty because, though I knew that sober well, lovely, apt word, and knew the ritual of bedding down cattle for the night, we had no herds like that on my island. We didn't have the climate, the pasture. The island had been developed for the cultivation of sugar cane. But there were cattle. Some members of my family, like other country people, kept cows, one or two, for milk, for love, for religion. We were at the very end of the old Aryan cow worship, the worship of the cow that gave milk, without which men's life would have been harder, and in some climates and lands, impossible. This worship was something our grandfathers had brought with them from peasant India. When I was a child, we still honoured the idea for its own sake, as well as for its link with the immemorial past. Among us, the new milk from a cow that had just calved was almost holy. A special sweet was made from this very rich milk, and sent by the cow's owner to friends and relations, sent in very small portions, like a consecrated offering from a religious rite. Our few cows, perhaps like Gray's or Goldsmith's herds, were poor things compared with the healthy big animals on the downs. But these animals on the downs, even with their beauty, were without the sanctity, the constant attention of men, which as a child I thought cows craved. These cows in railed pastures or meadows had numbers scored into their rumps. No sanctity at birth, and none at death, just the covered van. And sometimes, as once in the derelict mossy yard at the back of Jack's cottage, there were reminders of assisted insemination or gestation going wrong, when for some days, isolated from the animals that had all come out well, oddly made cattle were penned up there with that extra bit of flesh and hair, with the black and white Frisian pattern hanging down their middle, as of cow material that had leaked through the two halves of the cow mould. And now, with the disappearance of the cattle, they came to the old and new lanes and ways of the downs around the farm, whose life might have seemed to the visitor unchanging and ritualized, a moment of stasis, suspense. There had been great activity. Now there were more ruins than ever. The manor in whose grounds I lived, so many of its rooms shut up, the gardens of the manor, the forested orchard, the children's house there with a conical thatched roof, the thatch rotting, the thick stack of the damp reeds slipping out of the wire netting in one place, creating the effect at the bottom of a diagonal slicing of the reeds, the squash court that was not squash court or farmhouse, the old granary with a double pyramidal roof. Beyond the renovated church, the old farm buildings had been taken down and replaced by the prefabricated shed, which was now empty, with the round convex silver mirrors at the entrance to the cow yard as reminders of the traffic that had once been. The pink house, with the green-stained thatched roof and the shredding straw pheasant on the roof, its garden now a piece of waste ground. The new barn and the new half-slatted cowshed at the top of the hill, with the windbreak of pine and beech, trees which had grown so much since I had first seen them. At the bottom of that hill, the silage pit with the thick timber plank walls against the excavated hillside, the timber planks stained with creosote, the tyres all around, bought in such number from people who dealt in such things, tyres worn smooth for many miles on many roads, and the rubble of the excavation, hummocked and chalky white and full of grass and weeds. And these were set among older ruins. A small old farm building, perhaps from the last century, far to the right at the end of the overgrown track at the foot of the hill, and all the many farm buildings, old or very old, at the back of Jack's cottage. Along the driveway, the beehives, the house-shaped old rick, the old stone house, ruined walls alone, surrounded by trees which, tall and overhanging the ruin when I had first seen them, were now 10 years older. Vegetable nature moving on. Stone immovable. And in the walk in the other direction, away from the old Land Rover run of the old manager, the great Swiss rolls of hay still stacked in the space between the wood, outgrown, and the hill of larks, with the ancient barrows at the top, part of the pimpling of the downs as seen against the sky, those rolls of hay now as black and as earth-like as the older bales that, at the other end of the driveway, had indeed below their tattered plastic sheeting, turned to earth. Grass to hay to earth. My own time here was coming to an end. My time in the manor cottage, and in that particular part of the valley. My second childhood of seeing and learning. My second life, so far away from my first. I had tried almost from the beginning to make myself ready for this end. After the glory and surprise of the first spring on the river banks, the new reeds, the water clearing to crystal, freshing out, as I learned to say, but this water green and dark with olive-blue suggestions and with illusory depth where it reflected the thick, succulent growth on the banks and especially below trees. After that first spring, I would say, at least I had a spring here. And then I said, at least I had a spring and summer here. And at least I've had a year here. And so it went on, as the years passed, until time began to telescope, and experience itself began to change, the new season not truly new any more, bringing less of new experience than reminders of the old. One had begun to stack away the years, to count them, to take pleasure in the counting, accumulation. One autumn afternoon I had a slight choking fit as I walked past Jack's old cottage and the derelict old farmyard. The fit passed by the time I had got round the corner, cleared the farmyard and left behind the old metal and tangled wire and timber junk below the beeches. Not the birches near the fire pit, they were on the other side of the way. These beeches were at the edge of the farmyard, big trees now in their prime, their lowest branches very low, providing a wonderful, rich, enclosing shade in the summer that made me think of George Borrow and his wanderings in the Romany Rye and Lavengro. Past the beeches and the farm, in the familiar solitude of the grassy way, I began to breathe easily again. Some irritation, something in the air around the farmyard, some passing allergy, I thought, and did nothing about it when I went home. That evening the fit returned. It was like a continuation of the moment near Jack's cottage, but this time it stayed with me. And within 2 or 3 hours I was seriously ill. This was the illness that did away with whatever remained of youthfulness in me, and much had remained, diminished my energy and pushed me week by week during my convalescence, month by month, into middle age. It was the end, for me, of the manor cottage as well. The downs, the uplands, the river and its banks, the geography here was simple. Water drained off the downs to the river. After rain, on the paved lane beside the windbreak, there were the little pebbled rivulets I had minutely observed running between the asphalt edge and the grass verge, down to the public road and then over the road surface or through culverts towards the river. Little rivulets like that, but charged with beech mast, now fresh, now old, ran past my kitchen door after rain, and left little tide racks, almost of beech mast, debris, all down the path. My cottage was cold. The solid stone and flint walls, which I loved, for the warm colour of the stone especially, kept in this cold. The beech trees that embowered it also kept out the sun. Even in summer it never got warm. Even during the summer drought that killed the old mock orange shrub, I needed heat at night. The beauty of the place, the great love I had grown to feel for it, greater than for any other place I had known, had kept me there too long. My health had suffered, but I couldn't say then, and can't say now, that I minded. There is some kind of exchange always. For me, for the writer's gift and freedom, the labour and disappointments of the writing life, and the being away from my home. For that loss, for having no place of my own, this gift of the second life in Wiltshire, the second happier childhood, as it were, the second arrival, but with an adult's perception, at a knowledge of natural things, together with the fulfilment of the child's dream of a safe house in the wood. But there was the cold of the cottage, and the damp and mist of the glorious river bank, and the illnesses that come to people who have developed or inherited weak lungs. It was some time before I went walking again. I was working on a big book. At a certain stage in that kind of labour, energy becomes one. Mental energy, physical energy, the use of one depleting the other. And when I was sufficiently recovered, most of my energy went on my book. I was also, sadly, preparing to leave. Just a few miles away, on a dry down, I was converting 2 derelict agricultural cottages into a house. The cottages had been built 80 years or so before on the site of an old agricultural hamlet with a very old name. The old hamlet had disappeared. Nothing remained of it except a few level areas, little green platforms or terraces close to one another in certain meadows. During my own building work, old brick walls and brick foundations from the last century and the black earth of old latrines were dug up where, with smooth green slopes all around, I had been expecting only chalk. The walls and foundations of workers' houses. Generations of agricultural workers had lived on the site, and even in the pair of cottages I was renovating, the cottages that had been built early in the century over the foundations and debris of the old hamlet, many generations of workers, or many different people, had lived. Now I, an outsider, was altering the appearance of the land a little, doing what I had been aware of others doing, creating a potential ruin. And later, after I had moved there, when old people came to look at the cottages where they had lived or visited, I felt ashamed. And once, when a very old lady not far from death was brought by her grandson to look at the cottage where as a girl she had lived for a summer with her shepherd grandfather, and was so bewildered by the changed cottage she found that she thought she had come to the wrong place, once I pretended I didn't live there. I should have made a clean break, gone elsewhere. But having cut myself off from my first life, and having had unexpectedly, and 20 years after that earlier casting off, the good fortune to have found a second life, I was unwilling to move too far. I wanted to stay with what I had found. I wanted to recreate, so far as it was possible, what I had found in the manor cottage. One day, perhaps 9 or 10 months after I had fallen ill, I went on my old walk. New associations now, to add to the old, and as if to match my mood, I saw, almost as soon as I began to go down the hill beside the windbreak, a greater change at the bottom of the valley than any I had known. What had been the row of 3 farm cottages, one of which had been Jack's, was being converted into 1 big house. The basic work had been done. The 3 cottages, or so it appeared from the outside, had been turned into a large living room. New spaces or rooms had been added to this big central room. The roof of the house was being put on. New red blonde rafters. The design of the house was not elegant, but it was going to be roomy and comfortable, and every window would give a staggering green view of the droveway, or the slopes of the downs, the woods of birch and beech, or the lines of blackthorn and hawthorn along the lateral field lanes. Most of the old farm buildings had gone, but some of the back were still there, among them the old barn with a high loading window and the projecting metal bracket where a pulley and cable would once have helped to lift sacks or bales from loaded wagons and swing them into place inside. The builders were working on the roof, hanging slates fast. The van with the builder's name was on the driveway, where once Jack's geese had roamed. There was a radio playing loudly somewhere in the unfinished, hollow, reverberating building. The builders, town people, were more unwelcoming than the town farm workers had been. How exposed a house looks when it becomes a site for builders, how strict of sanctity when a room, once intimate, becomes mere space. Jack's cottage, whose interior I'd never seen until now, had been reduced without side wall or middle flooring to pure builder's space, and at this stage of building was still pure space, like the space within the ruined stone-walled house with the big sycamores further along the driveway. Somewhere in that space, Jack had made his bravest decision, to leave his deathbed for the last Christmas season with his friends, in the so ordinary public house not far from the end of the driveway. And that was the space to which, with what illness, delirium, resignation, or perhaps reconciliation, he had returned to die. I saw this new building going up in summer, in white chalk dust, but in winter, as I knew, the site had been one of mud and water settling at the bottom of the valley, mud and water many inches deep. That was the source of the damp that had given Jack his bronchitis and his pneumonia. But now that wet and damp had been dealt with. All the ground that had been Jack's garden and goose ground, and the gardens or grassed-over areas of the other cottages, all that had been concreted over, to create a forecourt for the big house. At the back, the concrete floor of Jack's greenhouse was not to be seen. The area had been incorporated into the new living space of the big house. So at last, Just as the house was cleansed of Jack's life and death, so the ground he had tended finally disappeared. But surely, below all that concrete over his garden, some seed, some root, would survive, and one day, perhaps, when the concrete was taken up, as surely one day it would be taken up, since few dwelling places are eternal, one day, perhaps some memory of Jack, preserved in some shrub or flower or vine, would come to life again. With that building of a big house, where once, perhaps for centuries, had stood the cottages or dwellings of farm or country labourers, a cycle had been completed. Once there would have been many hamlets, settlements of farm workers and shepherds, near the fording places along the river. These hamlets had dwindled. They had dwindled fast with the coming of machinery. Fewer hands had been needed, and then, when sheep stopped being kept, even shepherds were not needed. The garden of the manor, the forested orchard, lay partly on the site of one vanished hamlet. Such building over would have occurred many times before. The duplicate name of the hamlet or village, Waldenshaw, the same word, for forest or wood, in two tribal languages, both long since absorbed into other languages, the very name spoke of invaders from across the sea, and of ancient wars and dispossessions here along the picturesque river and the wet meadows. This history had repeated, had radiated outwards, as it were, much of the wealth for the Victorian Edwardian manor. Its gardens and ancillary buildings had come from the Empire, ventures abroad. Once the manor estate had covered many of the acres of my afternoon walks, but its glory had lasted one generation. The family had moved elsewhere. The estate had become the manor and grounds alone. It had shed its farms and land. Others had taken over those acres, built new big houses in villages or on the sites of hamlets once full of working people, and now the last of the peasant or farm cottages along the droveway had been taken over. What had once been judged a situation suitable only for agricultural cottages, next to a farm, far from roads and services, had become desirable. The farm had gone. The very distance from the public road was a blessing, and so the quality or attributes of the site changing the past had been abolished. I had lived, very soon after coming to the valley, with the idea of change, of the imminent dissolution of the perfection I had found. It had given a poignancy to the beauty I had experienced, the passing of the seasons. I had promised myself again and again, every spring, every autumn, to get a camera, or at least to relearn how to use the one I owned, to record the droveway and the ruined house below the sycamores and the gypsy caravan and the farm buildings and Jack's cottage and garden and goose ground. But I had never once taken a camera on my walks, and perhaps because I had no physical record of these things, they had an added poignancy, since they very soon began to exist only in my head. I had thought that because of my insecure past, peasant India, colonial Trinidad, my own family circumstances, the colonial smallness that didn't consort with the grandeur of my ambition, my uprooting of myself for a writing career, my coming to England with so little, and the very little I still had to fall back on, I had thought that because of this, I had been given an especially tender or raw sense of an unaccommodating world. I had seen Jack as solid, rooted in his earth, but I had also seen him as something from the past, a remnant, something that would be swept away before my camera would get the pictures. My ideas about Jack were wrong. He was not exactly a remnant. He had created his own life, his own world, almost his own continent, but the world about him, which he so enjoyed and used, was too precious not to be used by others. And it was only when he had gone, when the town workers who had replaced him had gone, it was only then that I saw how tenuous, really, the hold of all these people had been on the land they worked or lived in. Jack himself had disregarded the tenuousness of his hold on the land, just as, not seeing what others saw, he had created a garden on the edge of a swamp and a ruined farmyard, had responded to and found glory in the seasons. All around him was ruin, and all around, in a deeper way, was change, and a reminder of the brevity of the cycles of growth and creation. But he had sensed that life and man were the true mysteries, and he had asserted the primacy of these with something like religion. The bravest and most religious thing about his life was his way of dying. the way he had asserted, at the very end, the primacy not of what was beyond life, but life itself. My time was over in the valley, that particular rhythmical time of Manor Cottage and grounds and the special signs there of the seasons and walks on the downs and the riverbank. And I felt like that, that the second life I had been granted had ended, though I did not move far. The cottages I had been renovating were on the same bus route, the bus that made fewer trips, with fewer passengers, for more and more money. One day, a middle-aged woman spoke to me. Some of the people on the bus spoke to me. Some, even after 12 years, never did. I did not recognize the woman who spoke to me. She said, "Jack, Jack's wife." And then I remembered her face, and the cadaverous, wicked-eyed face of her father. She spoke of Jack, always, in this distant way, as though speaking of another person altogether, someone she had known rather than lived with. She said, "It's the hair you didn't recognize." She fingered her hair. It was short. She said, "Jack liked it long. He liked me to wear it in a bun." This was something new about Jack. From a distance, his own beard and his upright posture had made him look like a romantic, something like an early socialist in my fantasy, and perhaps he had copied the beard from an older person. Perhaps he had, after all, self-consciously lived out a certain kind of life. Perhaps in his own way he had been a tyrant, imposing, in addition to long hair and the bun, a style and way of life that had been irksome to his wife. She lived now in a small settlement of council houses in a small town in another valley. She liked the area, her house, her neighbours. She found it strange, no more than that, that a big house should have been put up where she had lived for all those years. She said, "Isn't it funny what they do?" For her, Jack's wife, the move away from the cottage had been good. She saw her life as a small success story. Father, a forester, a gamekeeper of sorts. Jack, the farm worker, the gardener, and now she half a townswoman. One cycle for me, in my cottage, in the grounds of the manor. Another cycle on the farm, among the farm buildings. Another cycle in the life of Jack's wife. The Journey. To write about Jack and his cottage and his garden, it was necessary for me to have lived a second life in the valley, and to have had a second awakening to the natural world there. But a version of that story, a version, came to me just days after I came to the valley, to the cottage in the manor grounds. The cottage at that time still had the books and some of the furniture of the people who had been there before. Among the books was one that was very small, a paperback booklet, smaller in format than the average small paperback and with only a few pages. The booklet, from a series called The Little Library of Art, was about the early paintings of Giorgio di Chirico. There were about a dozen reproductions of his early surrealist paintings. Technically, in these very small reproductions, the paintings did not seem interesting. They seemed flat, facile, and their content was not profound either. Arbitrary assemblages in semi-classical, semi-modern settings of unrelated motifs. Aqueducts, trains, arcades, gloves, fruit, statues, with an occasional applied touch of easy mystery. In one painting, for instance, an overlarge shadow of a hidden figure approaching from round a corner. But among these paintings there was one which, perhaps because of its title, caught my attention. The Enigma of Arrival. I felt that in an indirect, poetical way, the title referred to something in my own experience. And later I was to learn that the titles of these surrealist paintings of Chirico's hadn't been given by the painter, but by the poet, Apollinaire, who died young in 1918 from influenza following a war wound, to the great grief of Picasso and others. What was interesting about the painting itself, The Enigma of Arrival, was that, again, perhaps because of the title, it changed in my memory. The original, or the reproduction in the Little Library of Art booklet, was always a surprise. A classical scene, Mediterranean, ancient Roman, or so I saw it. A wharf, in the background beyond walls and gateways, like cutouts, there is the top of the mast of an antique vessel. On an otherwise deserted street in the foreground, there are two figures, both muffled, one perhaps the person who has arrived, the other perhaps a native of the port. The scene is of desolation and mystery. It speaks of the mystery of arrival. It spoke to me of that as it had spoken to Apollinaire. And in the winter grey of the manor grounds in Wiltshire, in those first 4 days of mist and rain, when so little was clear to me, an idea, floating lightly above the book I was working on, came to me of a story I might one day write about that scene in the Chirico picture. My story was to be set in classical times, in the Mediterranean. My narrator would write plainly, without any attempt at period style or historical explanation of his period. He would arrive, for a reason I had yet to work out, at that classical port with the walls and gateways like cutouts. He would walk past that muffled figure on the quayside. He would move from that silence and desolation, that blankness, to a gateway or door. He would enter there and be swallowed by the life and noise of a crowded city. I imagined something like an Indian bazaar scene. The mission he had come on, family business, study, religious initiation, would give him encounters and adventures. He would enter interiors of houses and temples. Gradually there would come to him a feeling that he was getting nowhere. He would lose his sense of mission. He would begin to know only that he was lost. His feeling of adventure would give way to panic. He would want to escape, to get back to the quayside and his ship. But he wouldn't know how. I imagined some religious ritual in which, led on by kindly people, he would unwittingly take part and find himself the intended victim. At the moment of crisis, he would come upon a door, open it, and find himself back on the quayside of arrival. He has been saved. The world is as he remembered it. Only one thing is missing now. Above the cut-out walls and buildings, there is no mast, no sail. The antique ship has gone. The traveller has lived out his life. I didn't think of this as an historical story, but more as a free ride of the imagination. There was to be no research. I would take pointers from Virgil, perhaps, for the sea and travel and the seasons, from the Gospels and the Acts of the Apostles for the feel of the municipal or provincial organization of the Roman Empire. I would get moods and the idea of ancient religion from Apuleius. Horace and Martial and Petronius would give me hints for social settings. The idea of living in my imagination in that classical Roman world was attractive to me. A beautiful, clear, dangerous world, far removed from the setting in which I had found myself. The story, more a mood than a story, so different from the book on which I was working. A taxing book. It had been occupying me for 8 or 9 months, and I still hadn't completed a draft. At the centre of the book I was writing was a story set in an African country, once a colony with white and Asian settlers, and now independent. It was the story of a day-long journey made in a car by 2 white people at a time of tribal war, suddenly coming, suddenly overwhelming colonial order and simplicity. Africa had given both those white people a chance, made them bigger, brought out their potential. Now, when they were no longer so young, it was consuming them. It was a violent book, not violent in its incidents, but in its emotions. It was a book about fear. All the jokes were silenced by this fear. And the mist that hung over the valley where I was writing, the darkness that came early, the absence of knowledge of where I was, all this uncertainty emanating from the valley I transferred to my Africa. And it did not occur to me that the story of The Enigma of Arrival, a sunlit sea journey ending in a dangerous classical city, which had come to me as a kind of release from the creative rigours and the darkness of my own African story, it did not occur to me that that Mediterranean story was really no more than a version of the story I was already writing. Nor did it occur to me that it was also an attempt to find a story for, to give coherence to, a dream or nightmare which for a year or so had been unsettling me. In this dream there occurred always, at a critical moment in the dream narrative, what I can only describe as an explosion in my head. It was how every dream ended, with this explosion that threw me flat on my back, in the presence of people, in a street, a crowded room, or wherever, threw me into this degraded posture in the midst of standing people, threw me into the posture of sleep in which I found myself when I awakened. The explosion was so loud, so reverberating and slow in my head that I felt, with the part of my brain that miraculously could still think and draw conclusions, that I couldn't possibly survive, that I was in fact dying, that the explosion this time, in this dream, regardless of the other dreams that had revealed themselves at the end as dreams, would kill, that I was consciously living through or witnessing my own death. And when I awoke, my head felt queer, shaken up, exhausted, as though some discharge in my brain had in fact occurred. This dream or nightmare or internal dramatization, perhaps a momentary turbulence in my brain, had created the split-second tableau of the street, the cafe, the party, the bus, where I collapsed in the presence of people, had been with me for a year or more. It was a dream that had been brought on by intellectual fatigue and something like grief. I had written a lot, done work of much difficulty, had worked under pressure more or less since my school days. Before the writing, there had been the learning. Writing had come to me slowly. Before that, there had been Oxford, and before that, the school in Trinidad, where I had worked for the Oxford scholarship. There had been a long preparation for the writing career, and then I discovered that to be a writer was not, as I had imagined, a state of competence or achievement or fame or content at which one arrived and where one stayed. There was a special anguish attached to the career, whatever the labour of any piece of writing, whatever its creative challenges and satisfactions. Time had always taken me away from it, and with time passing, I felt mocked by what I had already done. It seemed to belong to a time of vigour, now past for good. Emptiness, restlessness built up again, and it was necessary once more, out of my internal resources alone, to start on another book, to commit myself to that consuming process again. I had finally been undermined. My spirit had broken. And that breaking of the spirit had occurred not long before I had come to the valley. For 2 years I had worked on an historical book about the region where I had been born. The book had grown, and since, beyond a certain length, a big book is harder to write, more exhausting than a shorter one, I had resisted its growth. But then I had become excited by the story it told. The historian seeks to abstract principles from human events. My approach was the other. For the 2 years that I lived among the documents, I sought to reconstruct the human story as best I could. It was a labour. 10 or 12 documents, called up from memory, almost like personal memories, might provide the details for a fairly short and simple paragraph of narrative, but I was supported by my story, the themes it touched on. Discovery, the new world, the dispeopling of the discovered islands, slavery, the creation of the plantation colony, the coming of the idea of revolution, the chaos after revolutions in societies so created. A great packed education those 2 years had been, and I had such faith in what I was writing, such faith in the grandeur of my story, that I thought it would find the readers that my books of the previous 12 years had not found. And I behaved foolishly. Without waiting for that response, I dismantled the little life I had created for myself in England and prepared to leave, to be a free man. For years in that far-off island whose human history I had been discovering and writing about, I had dreamed of coming to England. But my life in England had been savourless, and much of it mean. I had taken to England all the rawness of my colonial's nerves, and those nerves had more or less remained, nerves which in the beginning were in a good part also the nerves of youth and inexperience, physical and sexual inadequacy, and of undeveloped talent. And just as once at home I had dreamed of being in England, so for years in England I had dreamed of leaving England. Now, 18 years after my first arrival, it seemed to me that the time had come. I dismantled the life I had, bit by bit, established and prepared to go. The house I had bought and renovated in stages I sold, and my furniture and books and papers went to the warehouse. The calamity occurred 4 months later. The book in which I had placed such faith, the book which had exhausted me so much, could not please the publisher who had commissioned it. We had misunderstood one another. He knew only my name. He did not know the nature of my work, and I had misunderstood his interest in me. He had approached me as a serious writer, but he had wanted only a book for tourists, something much simpler than the book I had written, something at once more romantic and less romantic, at once more human and less human. So I found myself up in the air, and I had to return to England. That journey back, from the island and continent I had gone to see with my new vision, the corner of the new world I had just written about, from there to the United States and Canada and then to England, that journey back to England so mimicked and parodied the journey of 19 years before, the journey of the young man, the boy, almost, who had journeyed to England to be a writer in a country where the calling had some meaning, that I couldn't but be aware of all the cruel ironies. It was out of this grief, too deep for tears or rage, grief that began partly to be expressed in the dream of the exploding head, that I began to write my African story, which had come to me as a wisp of an idea in Africa 3 or 4 years before. The African fear with which, as a writer, I was living day after day, the unknown Wiltshire, the cruelty of this return to England, the dread of a second failure, the mental fatigue, all of this, rolled into one, was what lay on the spirit of the man who went on the walks down to Jack's cottage and past it. Not an observer, merely, a man removed, but a man played on, worked on, by many things. And it was out of that burden of emotion that there had come to the writer as release, as an idyll, the ship's story, the antique quayside story suggested by The Enigma of Arrival, an idea that came innocently, without the writer's suspecting how much of his life, how many aspects of his life, that remote story, still just an idea for a story, carried. But that is why certain stories or incidents suggest themselves to writers, or make an impression on them. That is why writers can appear to have obsessions. I went for my walks every afternoon. I finished my book. The panic of its composition didn't repeat in the revision. I was beginning to heal, and more than heal. For me, a miracle had occurred in this valley, and in the grounds of the manor where my cottage was. In that unlikely setting, in the ancient heart of England, a place where I was truly an alien, I found I was given a second chance, a new life, richer and fuller than any I had had anywhere else. And in that place, where at the beginning I had looked only for remoteness and a place to hide, I did some of my best work. I travelled. I wrote. I ventured out, brought back experiences to my cottage, and wrote. The years passed. I healed. The life around me changed. I changed. And then one afternoon came that choking fit, as I was walking past Jack's old cottage, Jack himself long dead. A few hours later came the serious illness which that choking fit had presaged, and when, after some months, I recovered, I found myself a middle-aged man. Work became harder for me. I discovered in myself an unwillingness to undertake new labour. I wished to be free of labour. And whereas when I came to the valley my dream was the dream provoked by fatigue and unhappiness, the dream of the exploding head, the certainty of death, now it was the idea of death itself that came to me in my sleep. Death not as a tableau or a story, as in the earlier dream, but death, the end of things, as a gloom that got at a man, sought out his heart when he was at his weakest, while he slept. This idea of death, death, the nullifier of human life and endeavour, to which morning after morning I awakened, so enervated me that it sometimes took me all day, all the hours of daylight, to see the world as real again, to become a man again, a doer. The dream of exhaustion once, now the debilitation brought on by involuntary thoughts of the final emptiness. This too was something that happened to the man who went walking, witness of people and events in the valley. It was as though the calling, the writer's vocation, was one that could never offer me anything but momentary fulfilment, so that again, years after I had seen the Chirico picture and the idea for the story had come to me, again in my own life, was another version of the story of The Enigma of Arrival. And indeed, there had been a journey long before. The journey that had seeded all the others, and had indirectly fed that fantasy of the classical world. There had been a journey, and a ship. This journey began some days before my 18th birthday. It was the journey which, for a year, I feared I would never be allowed to make, so that even before the journey I lived with anxiety about it. It was the journey that took me from my island Trinidad off the northern coast of Venezuela to England. There had, first, been an airplane. A small one of the period, narrow, with a narrow aisle and flying low. This had given me my first revelation, the landscape of my childhood seen from the air, and from not too high up. At ground level, so poor to me, so messy, so full of huts and gutters, and bare front yards and straggly hibiscus hedges, and shabby backyards, views from the roadside. From the air, though, a landscape of logic and larger pattern, the straight lines and regularity and woven carpet-like texture of sugarcane fields, so extensive from up there, leaving so little room for people, except at the very edges. The large unknown area of swampland, curiously still, the clumps of mangrove and brilliant green swamp trees casting black shadows on the milky green water. The forested peaks and dips and valleys of the mountain range, a landscape of clear pattern and contours, absorbing all the roadside messiness, a pattern of dark green and dark brown, like camouflage, like a landscape in a book, like the landscape of a real country. So that at the moment of take-off, almost, the moment of departure, the landscape of my childhood was like something which I had missed, something I had never seen. Minutes later, the sea. It was wrinkled, as in the fragment of the poem by Tennyson. It glinted in the sun. It was grey and silver rather than blue, and again, as in the fragment by Tennyson, it did crawl. So that again the world in which I had lived all my life so far was a world I had never seen. And then the little airplane rose just above the clouds, and flew like that, just above the clouds, until we reached Puerto Rico. I had heard about the beauty of the clouds, seen from the top, from someone who had travelled to Jamaica, perhaps in an even smaller airplane 5 years before. So this was a beauty and an experience which I was ready for, and was overwhelmed by. Always, above the cloud, the sun. So solid, the cloud, so pure. I could only look and look. Truly to possess that beauty, to feel that one had come to the end of that particular experience, was impossible. To see what so few men had seen. Always there, the thing seen, the world above the clouds, even when unperceived. Up there, as down below sometimes at sunset, one's mind could travel back and forward eons. We droned on to Puerto Rico. It was late afternoon. Another country, already. After only a few hours. Travel. Another language. People of mixed race. Mulattoes. But subtly different from the mixed people of my own place. There was a Negro in the hangar. Or so the place seemed to me. There was no airport terminal to speak of. Air travel, though a luxury, still had in those days a rough and ready side. The Negro was from the little airplane. I asked him whether he was from Trinidad. Of course he was. I knew that. I had seen him in the plane. But I asked him. Why? Friendship? I didn't need that. I noted the falsity in my behaviour. In the hangar or shed there was a man from another plane, or waiting for another plane, who was reading that day's edition of the New York Times. This large world had always existed outside my little island, like the sun above the clouds, always there, even when unperceived, and this large world was now within reach. For 8 hours, or was it 13? We drove on in a dark sky to New York, hours away from the life of my island, where nothing had savour and even the light had a life-killing quality, as I thought. I lived, like any peasant coming for the first time to a capital city, in a world of marvels. I had always known that this world existed, but to find it available to me only for the price of a fare was nonetheless staggering. With the marvels, however, they went, as in a fairy story, a feeling of menace. As the little plane droned and droned through the night, the idea of New York became frightening. Not the city so much as the moment of arrival. I couldn't visualize that moment. It was the first traveler's panic I had experienced. The passenger beside me was an Englishwoman. She had a child with her. I saw them only in that way, an Englishwoman and a child. I had no means of placing them. I wrote my diary. I had bought, for that purpose, a cheap little lined pad with a front cover that held envelopes in a pocket. I also had an indelible mauve pencil of the sort that serious people, especially officials in Trinidad, used in those days. When you licked the pencil, the colour became bright. Dry, the colour was dull. I had bought the pad and the pencil because I was travelling to become a writer. And I had to start. I asked the stewardess to sharpen my pencil. I did so partly to taste the luxuriousness of air travel. The plane was small, but it offered many little services, or so the airline advertisements said. This request to the stewardess was in the nature of a challenge, and to my amazement, the stewardess, white and American and to me, radiant and beautiful and adult, took my request seriously, brought the pencil back, beautifully sharpened, and called me, 2 weeks away from being 18, sir. So I wrote my diary. But it left out many of the things that were worth noting down, many of the things which, some years later, I would have thought much more important than the things I did note down. The diary I wrote in the airplane left out the great family farewell at the airport in Trinidad, the airport building like a little timber house, with a little garden at the edge of the asphalt runway. That family farewell was the last of the big Hindu or Asiatic occasions in which I took part, those farewells from another era, another continent, another kind of travel, when a traveller might indeed never return, as many of us or our grandfathers had never returned to India, for which people left their work, gave up a day's earnings, and travelled long distances to say goodbye. And not really to say goodbye, more to show themselves, to be present at a big clan occasion, to assert their membership of the clan, in spite of the fact, or because of the fact, that there were now such differences between various branches of the extended family, and conversation was already touched with condescension or social nervousness on one side or the other. I did not note down that occasion in my writer's diary with the indelible pencil, sharpened by the elegant Pan-American World Airways stewardess in the little airplane, and one reason was that the occasion was too separate from the setting in which I wrote, the setting of magic and wonder. Another was that the occasion, that ceremonial farewell with stiff little groups of people hanging about the wooden building at the edge of the runway, did not fit into my idea of a writer's diary, or the writer's experience I was preparing myself for. Nor did I write about something I would certainly have written about not many years later, when I began to work towards some understanding of the nature of my experience, the cousin and his advice at the airport. This cousin was a half-witted, or certainly dim-witted fellow who had developed a little paunch at the age of 15 or so, had kept it ever since, and had in some bizarre way, without any knowledge of grammar or feeling for the English language or any other language, made himself a journalist. He had no goodwill towards me. Perhaps he even had ill will. Perhaps he would have easily, not out of any positive malice, but half-heartedly as befitted his character and out of a simple principle of family hate, done the equivalent of sticking pins in my effigy. But he was moved by the occasion, or felt he had to act up to it, and at that crowded farewell at the airport, where a few people, some of whom I didn't know, were even managing to cry, this cousin came up to me and, as though passing on a secret handed to him a journalist from the highest quarters, from the airport manager, from the director of Pan American World Airways, or from God himself, whispered, "Sit at the back of the airplane. It's safer there." Travel was still an adventure, by sea or by air, and it may be that what my cousin said about sitting at the back of the airplane was right. Perhaps, though, and more likely, his advice was based on the child's comic strip idea of the airplane crash, the plane diving down, crashing on its nose. I didn't write about this cousin and his advice in my airplane diary because, like the family send-off, the remnant of peasant Asia in my life, the frivolous advice did not seem to me suitable to the work, which was about a more epic vision of the world and about a more epic kind of personal adventure. Perhaps it never even occurred to me to write about the farewell or the cousin's advice. There was no question of rejecting the themes. But though personal adventure was my theme, I was in no position to write about something more important, the change in my personality that travel and solitude had already begun to bring about. The intimations of this alteration were very slight. In 5 years, I was to see very clearly that the family farewell and my cousin's advice were material. But it was to be many years after that before the alterations in my personality, or the slight intimations I was beginning to have about those alterations, intimations that were minute fractions of that first day's adventure, were to acquire their proper proportions. There had been the Negro in the hangar, or airport shed in Puerto Rico, where, after many hours and in the late afternoon, our little airplane had made its first halt. Already the light had changed. The world had changed. The world had ceased to be colonial for me. People had already altered their value, even this Negro. He was bound for Harlem. At home, among his fellows, just a few hours before, he was a man to be envied, his journey indescribably glamorous. Now he was a Negro, in a straw-coloured jacket, obviously not his own, too tight across his weightlifter's shoulder. Weightlifting was a craze among us. Now, in that jacket, at home, the badge of the traveller to the temperate north, he was bluffing it out, insisting on his respectability, on not being an American Negro, on not being fazed by the airplane and by the white people. He was not an educated man, not someone I would have sought out at home. Yet already I had sought him out and even claimed kinship with him. Why? I felt the gestures of friendship to be false, even as I made them. In his tight, respectable jacket, he was cool with me, and I was half glad he was, because friendship, chat with him, wasn't what I wanted. But I had made the gestures. If I had been asked whether I was feeling solitary, vulnerable, I would have said that the opposite was true, that I was in a state of great excitement, that I was loving everything, that everything I had seen so far in the second half of that great day was new and wonderful. He was cool, the Trinidad man, buttoned up, his eyes quiet, no shine to his colour, which had rather a matte or dead quality that spoke of tension. I let him be. I stayed by myself. The light yellowed, darkened. Then we were airborne again. The little airplane droned on and on. The repetitiveness of this form of travel was an unexpected revelation, so that though the journey was the fastest I had ever made, and though I knew that, compared with a ship's journey, it was extraordinarily short, yet it was neither exaggerated nor pretentious to feel that it was boring. There were the woman and her child beside me. The woman was English, as I have said. I had never met an Englishwoman of her age before, had indeed met only one Englishwoman, and had no means of reading her character or intelligence or education. I was not interested in children, was not interested in women with children, yet towards this woman, much taken up with her child, I found myself making overtures of friendship. I was carrying some bananas to New York. They were in a paper bag, perhaps on the floor, some remnant of old peasant travel with food for the journey, some genuine Hindu distrust of the food that might be offered by the airplane and then by the hotel in New York. The bananas were smelling now. In the warm plane, they were ripening by the hour. I offered the woman a banana. Did she take it for her child? I cannot remember. The fact was, I made the offer, though really I didn't want this woman's friendship or conversation, and was not interested in the child. Was there some fear of travel, in spite of my longing for the day, and in spite of my genuine excitement? Was this reaching out to people a response to solitude, since for the first time in my life I was solitary? Was it the fear of New York? Certainly. The city, my behaviour there at the moment of arrival, my inability to visualise the physical details of arrival, how and where I was going to spend the night, these were developing anxieties as we flew on and on. I witnessed this change in my personality, but, not even aware of it as a theme, wrote nothing of it in my diary, so that between the man writing the diary and the traveller, there was already a gap between the man and the writer. Man and writer were the same person. But that is a writer's greatest discovery. It took time, and how much writing, to arrive at that synthesis. On that day, the first of adventure and freedom and travel and discovery, man and writer were united in their eagerness for experience, but the nature of the experiences of the day encouraged a separation of the two elements in my personality. The writer, or the boy travelling to be a writer, was educated. He had had a formal school education. He had a high idea of the nobility of the calling to which he was travelling to dedicate himself. But the man, of whom the writer was just a part, if a major impelling part, the man was in the profoundest way, as a social being, untutored. He was close to the village ways of his Asian Indian community. He had an instinctive understanding of and sympathy for its rituals, like the farewell at the airport that morning. He was close to the ways of that community, which was separated from peasant India only by two or three generations in a plantation colony of the New World. Yet there was another side to the man. He did not really participate in the life or rituals of that community. It wasn't only that he was educated in the formal way of a school education, he was also sceptical. Unhappy in his extended family, he was distrustful of larger communal